Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I apologize to my listeners. Last week I was ill, and I wasn't on Matt Heinbeck's show, and I didn't put out an Orthodox Nationalist. But I'm 100% now, and I want to go back to the roots of what we do on this show. This show is dedicated to the Russian Orthodox Church and the nationalist movement that it is very much a part of in the world. Many, many years ago, I had predicted that Vladimir Putin was going to be the new, more or less, restrainer of the forces of Antichrist. And on this show, you realize that Antichrist has a political and an economic manifestation. In fact, it is driven by greed to a great extent, and that we call globalization. When I refer to the New World Order, or globalization, or globalism, or anything like that, internationalism, what I'm referring to largely is an economic process where the world's capitalist giants, trying to lower transaction costs to the absolute minimum, to force wages down to the absolute minimum, but in a longer view, seek to destroy anything that would maintain a stable, virtuous society. And those especially are the family, nations, communities, and differences among civilizations. Keep in mind always that there is absolutely nothing conservative in the true sense of the word about capitalism. It is even the free market only works just like democracy. It only works if you have a virtuous population to begin with. But there is absolutely nothing about it that promotes virtue. Adam Smith was a revolutionary, and the system that he was justifying was revolutionary. It was capitalism is the way that, or the free market, I should say, the way that Adam Smith laid it out in his utilitarian way, was another version of the revolutionary concept of the state of nature. His state of nature was strictly an economic one, and he removed everything from the social picture except producers of items that are more or less identical with a population that was abstractly unified and fully aware and knowledgeable of the different producers and what they were doing. That is perfect competition. It's a thought experiment. It's not meant to ever have existed. The situation in Russia in the early 90s, as many of you know, is what brought me into this field in the first place. After, you know, the wall coming down and communism falling, which was my big push into it, the next was the complete rape of the country. And rape is too soft of a word, I think, to describe what happened in the decade of the 90s. The decade of the 90s almost destroyed Russia. They were able to survive, you know, Hitler's invasion and Napoleon and Mongols and everybody else, but they couldn't handle liberalism for more than a few years. The economic destruction of Hitler's invasion in 1941 was roughly about 40% of the economy was destroyed. Between 1990 and 1997, about 80% of the Russian and former Soviet economy was liquidated and shipped abroad, or simply destroyed for scrap. So as the communist movement was largely an ethnically Jewish movement for acting as a transmission belt for the wealth of the Russian population, the same group of people, the same ethnic group of people anyway, used the opposite ideology, or what allegedly the opposite ideology of the free market, to take everything that had been created in the Soviet period. Now, like it or not, I'd be happy to send you the list of the names. For those of you who are unaware of this, the overwhelming majority of the communists in prior to Stalin were Jewish. This is not a coincidence. There was something ethnic about that movement. At the same time, we have to remember that in the 90s, the oligarchs that had taken over were, with one exception, Potanin, completely Jewish. Now, I suppose you could make believe that this is a wild coincidence, where 1%, less than 1% of the Russian population the population living within the borders of Russia, took over the country twice and bled it dry. I think there are a lot of people who are forced to believe that. And people, Russia specialists in the universities, they know this is true, but they have driven it from their minds. And if you go out with them, you know, I've done this more than once, get a couple of shots into them, and they'll start talking. Yeah, they know I'm right. And they'll admit this. The males will, anyway, especially the older males. But the gig is too good. The job is simply too good. It's the easiest job in the world. Being a university professor, you just talk about stuff that you know about. You do research, stuff that you would probably do anyway, if you really have a love for the field. You're teaching once in a while, students, and in the Ivy Leagues, they don't really teach at all. And, yeah, you get the free research from your students, you get all the girls you want, you get, I mean, you know, it's just, you work a few months out of the year, you get tenure, you know, where you can't even be fired for anything having to do with your position, teaching position. You know, few jobs, and in the big university, you're making six figures. So the gig, and you get a few shots into these guys, they will tell you that the job is simply too good. It's not worth jeopardizing with these issues that they can't do much about anyway. So to some extent, it's really hard to attack them, but I'll do it anyway, because that's not their job. The job of a philosopher, the job of a historian, the job of any scholar, I think, is a very simple one. We will not be taken in by appearances, images, stuff that, quote unquote, everybody knows. These are just images that we are born and raised with. Our job is to go behind these images, the power, the fear that keeps certain questions from being broached, and get to the essence of the matter. If there is no essence to the matter, if there is no truthful core of our subject matters, then there's no point in being a scholar at all, and it really is just a game. So, being a relativist, some of these guys, especially older males, are relativists just out of, because it's easy. And they're not going to ruin you know, their pension and everything else for the sake of the truth. At the same time, you have people like Kevin MacDonald and myself who have suffered greatly because of this. The great FBI agent, he was second in line to be a vice director of the FBI, Ted Gunderson, who was a friend of mine, another Nebraska graduate, who gave up his pension, gave up his whole life to pursue the child molesters that existed at the highest reaches of government and in the corporate world. So, you know, remember, the bad guys are the Western capitalists. Capitalism is a revolutionary, extremely liberal ideology that knows no moral boundaries. It knows no boundaries of any kind whatsoever. And this is what the Russian monarchy existed to keep from ruling the world. 100 years ago this year, Tsar Nicholas allegedly resigned his office, and then in 1918 was executed. And so next year, especially 1918, is a very special year. That is the 100-year anniversary. And right after the resignation of the Tsar, the removal of the restrainer in America, the largest influenza epidemic in the history of the world, one of the largest disease epidemics ever, even bigger than the Black Death, engulfed many countries in our hemisphere, killing many millions. It began right after Tsar Nicholas's alleged abdication, and it reached fever pitch right around the time of his execution, and then slowly died down. Coincidence, maybe. But again, part of our job is to ignore those really easy answers, an image of that stuff can't be real, and trying to get to the essence of the matter, which is the same thing as getting to the truth of the matter. That's the purpose of this show. That's the purpose of doing this show. It's nothing but lectures from me. It's just like how I teach my university classes. It's nothing but just me, the subject matter, and the students, and the listeners. You don't need anything else. If that's too much, then do something else. You know, this isn't for you. This is how we learn. This is how we approach the subject matter. And today the subject matter is St. Daniel, the Prince of Moscow, the founder of the Muscovite line, who died in 1303. He is the fourth son of St. Alexander Nevsky. And then he gave birth to several children, two of which matter politically. That is Yuri, or George, of Moscow, and Ivan the First, Kalita, or the generous. It means money bags, but it means money bags in a non-judgmental way. Kalita means man who is generous with money. He would carry around gold coins in a bag and give it to all the poor in the city of Moscow. And that's significant because as Moscow begins its slow rise to rule all the Eastern Slavic lands, one of the reasons it grew was that it took refugees in from all the other parts of the Slavic world. And that's one of the reasons the population grew tremendously. I think the American presidential election got a lot of us off track on secular pursuits, but that's over. Today is the 17th of January, 2017, and he is soon to be inaugurated, and I don't as yet know what's going to happen. As some of you may have heard, the leftist terrorists, again, disproportionately Jewish, at least at the leadership levels, with a lot of corporate money, are planning on using terrorism, bombs, and anything they can. The Veritas leaks, some of you may know of, where the left is threatening to simply, cause mass chaos and death if possible. And the good news there, really, is that mainstream conservatives, who are pretty useless as a group of people, are starting to realize that they can't hide anymore. They're going to be targeted too. Anybody even vaguely on the right, so-called, of the political spectrum, which is a distortion, we all know that, but for the sake of easy communication, anybody on the right of the political spectrum is going to come under attack from those people. And, the true nationalists and conservatives in the 19th century sense of the term have been kept out of a lot of the deplorable and stuff like that, but that's had no real effect. They're going to try to destroy it. They're going to try to kill Donald Trump. He survived four assassination attempts already. And frankly, it's the same group of people who overthrew the Tsar in 1917, 1918, 100 years ago. But we're going to the beginning of this line in Moscow, and that is Daniel of Moscow. Now, this is a time where Russia was ruled by the Mongols. Now, I'm not, if you go to my website, rusjournal.org, and there's a link here at the Daily Stormers radio page, where I do take issue with whether or not these were actual Asians. I don't believe they were. It doesn't matter. It doesn't affect anything that we're doing here tonight. But the concept is these were probably Slavs from the steppe or the plains in the southern part of the country, having more in common with the Cossacks than with Chinese. There is absolutely no local records of Chinese and Mongolians having a Slavic empire. Now, in Russia itself, no one believes that Asiatics ever took over Russia. The official textbooks in secondary schools as well as universities, wherever an official textbook would make sense, rejects the idea. For some reason, that hasn't made its way in English yet, but I've been reading the major works denying that Asiatics took over Russia. In this program, very early on, the first year I was doing this, 2009, I believe it was, I gave you a kind of a glimpse of the Mongol Empire. And back then, it was a long time ago, I fell into some of the old traps that these were Asiatics, that they were hundreds of thousands from China and Central Asia and everything else. And there's not tons of evidence that that's the case. One very strong piece of evidence is that whenever you see a contemporary picture, painting of a battle scene, you can't tell the difference, whether it be, Dmitry Donskoy, any of these people. You can't see the difference between the two sides. You can't tell who is Slavic and who is Asiatic. Now, every other contemporary painting showing, let's say, a Turkic group or something like that, it's very obvious that they're not ethnically Russians, that they're not Slavs. They go out of their way to show the differences in iconic form, except when they show the Mongols. It has to be a contemporary, high Middle Ages painting. Later on, they began showing them with Asian features, but contemporary paintings will not show them as Asian, will not show them as any different whatsoever from Slavs. And if you were to look at one of the, you know, 13th century paintings from that era, you can't tell the difference, what side is which. So it may well have been a North versus South battle among Slavs. And, you know, Russians have a long history of fighting invaders until the last drop of their blood. They're known for this. Everyone but the Mongols. The Mongols, they fought briefly and then welcomed. The Mongols supported the church, supported Moscow, made Moscow into the power that it became. These Slavic princes fought on the Mongol side with no problem. But these terms in Greek, Mongol comes from megalo, or great, powerful. Tartar just comes from Tartarus. These aren't really ethnic designations. Now, there may have been plenty of people from Central Asia involved in this invasion in the 13th century of Russia. Something else to keep in mind as well, though, is when the books were burned under Peter the Great, really actually before him, really under Alexis, the precedence books, they were called, where the great noble families of Russia had their family histories recorded, actually in great detail. These were hunted down and burnt en masse. So we have huge portions of Russian history that's blank to us now, because Alexis and Peter and many in between were torching these books wherever they could find them. And there was a campaign allegedly to institute a meritocracy. That's what the modern historian will tell you. No one from the era, though, thought that. This was an attempt to erase the history of powerful noble clans. Now, generally speaking, erasing, you know, removing them from political power is a good thing. They were extremely negative oligarchic force in Russian history. The problem is, in burning these precedence books, which family is more eminent, and here's the historical proof that they're more eminent, that's what these books really were for, a lot of very good history was destroyed in the process. No doubt it was biased towards the family, it may have been a limited value, but there was a lot of data in there, the few that remain. There certainly is some data in there. So the Mongol era is very much mysterious for that reason. But it doesn't affect the narrative tonight about St. Daniel and his son Ivan I. So it's not that big of a deal. But if you're interested, I have an article, also something that came out in the Barnes Review. Many of you know that I've been the editor of the Barnes Review for many, many years. Unfortunately, when the company went bankrupt again, I guess this was 2004, I lost my job with a few other people there, but I've always maintained very good relationships with the late Willis Cardo, the man who made my career possible, and his wife Elizabeth, who I get along with very, very well, who does not take an active role in publishing, but certainly does have some business sense that's usable on occasion. And she's a friend of mine. And I show her great respect, as she deserves, in honor especially of her late husband. There's no nationalism, populism in the true sense without Willis Cardo in this country. All other of the original groups, whether it be Pierce or Rockwell, any of these groups, they came into existence because of Willis. They were all using Willis's mailing lists, and he was the one who organized and financed the nationalist movement in this country. And rather than using the word oligarch, he was using the word plutocrat, starting in the early 60s. So he's been onto this for a very, very long time, and he's a man who I admire very much. But now there's only a handful of full-time people at the American Free Press and the Barnes Review, two separate but closely related companies, and I work for them both. But my title is a senior researcher in Russian and European history for the Barnes Review, and I take that very seriously. And my critique of the traditional view of the Mongols is a part of the Barnes Review from an issue or two issues ago. And it's certainly revisionist history. It's taken for granted in Russia, but not known very well in America. Well, St. Daniel is, of course, in a very different era. It would connect with the High Middle Ages in the West. The Russian chronology is different. We don't have time to get into that now, but it would be, you know, this is, you know, at a time where, you know, Thomas Aquinas was at his peak when Daniel was ruling Moscow. Remember, at the time, Moscow was a relatively small, minor principality, but its main rival was the city of Tver. Now, a piece of evidence that the church, the Orthodox Church in Russia, did not canonize people who supported Moscow or supported Muscovite nationalism is in the fact that the leadership of Tver at the time, all three, Fyodor, Alexander, and Michael, were murdered in wars with Moscow, murdered at the Horde in the southern part of the country, and two of them were canonized, Alexander and Michael. And they are celebrated princely figures in the Orthodox Church. So clearly, the canonization process has nothing to do with politics. It has to do with their inner disposition, and at least in terms of princes, or princely rule, what they did externally for their societies. Remember something. Tver at the time was a bit larger than Moscow. That was not going to last long. It was highly westernized. And the thing that worried everybody was that they were in union near the end of Daniel's reign with the Grand Duchy Lithuania. Lithuania at the time was large, Russian, Slavic, and Orthodox. So you had Lithuania and Tver claiming to be the ruler, the leader of the Russian Orthodox people and even the Third Rome. There are several places that call themselves the Third Rome, Tanovo in Bulgaria, the Grand Duchy of Lithuania for a while, and Tver in addition to Moscow. So that's not a new designation. And even if they didn't use those precise terms, the political theory of all of these places were exactly identical with what later developed as the Third Rome. And it's for this reason, partially, that I titled my first book that I wrote a long time ago, The Third Rome, which was essentially a outline of what my research agenda for the rest of my life was going to be. And although, you know, there's been more recent editions, and I have a podcast from some years ago talking about the things that I've retracted from that book, I was very young at the time, and I was very angry at the time. Why was I angry? I was angry because American historians are pretty useless people. They really are. They're like, you know, they're uniformly liberal in a kind of a vague way. I've known hundreds of them over the years. They're divided between older and younger men and women. The younger women actually believe the liberal stuff is true. They're often very naive and frankly ignorant. They're where they are because of affirmative action. That might not be the case with the older female professors, though. You'll find some surprising views among some of the older females, you know, women over 50 in academia today. Amongst men, young men, I don't believe, accept a lot of the liberalism. In other words, these guys, had they become plumbers or electricians rather than academics, they wouldn't hold any of these things. I have a number of academics who privately said that that's the case. But they live in fear. They live in fear of being called racist or sexist. And what they do, because they know they have a very great job, a very hard to get job, actually, they'll overcompensate. And they'll be the first ones to persecute someone like me out of fear. They try to make themselves beyond question a member of the establishment. And so they'll be the most vocal and loud and most radical of your campus pains in the ass. The older men have a tendency to be more reserved, and they have a tendency not really to buy, to be more cynical and relativist. Your relativist is when they don't, you know, they've given up on everything, and they're safe with the relativist position. With a few issues, you know, with the Holocaust, maybe you can't really be relativist there. The civil rights movement, you can't be relativist there. They'll throw you out for that, even with tenure. Tenure doesn't mean much anymore. And that's how it breaks down in academia. But to get tenure, to matter in academia, you have to spout a line. Everyone knows that. You have to conform, and the conformity is ideological. It's some form of liberalism or left radicalism. You have no choice. Wherever I've taught now at five universities in America, and my student evaluations are in the top 1% of every single place that I've ever taught. students absolutely love me, and it hasn't helped my career at all. So ideological conformism, and it's not like I went in there, you know, talking about George Lincoln Rockwell. I mean, that's nonsense. I would never do anything like that. But clearly, I didn't fit in. That was certain. And so teaching ability, research, books, articles, that is radically secondary to spouting the line. You are hired and then given tenure 6 years later, the full-time academic job in history, political science, philosophy, if you are reliable ideologically. Everything else is negotiable. And so I was angry when I wrote The Third Rome. And I was angry because I know, as these guys are writing, their liberal take on Russian history is so bad and so contradictory. They'll contradict themselves on the next page. To think that they don't know this, that they haven't noticed this, is ridiculous. Of course they have. They have to condemn, almost in a ritualistic way, the idea that the early communists in Russia were disproportionately, almost exclusively Jewish. Not quite. Despite all the contemporary evidence, despite all the names you could find and where they're from, if I could show it to them, I've shoved it in their faces before. And depending on who I'm doing that with, they're either scared, they're angry, and I, you know, ultimately it comes down to, I can't say this, I can't talk about them. And so they have prostituted themselves on this and many, many other issues. The result is very bad history and mythology that masquerades as an academic textbook. I'm at a point now, I taught myself Russian at the end of grad school, beginning of my time at the Barnes Review. And so I kind of learned Ukrainian at the same time. There's some substantial differences. And I would do, if I had to do it again, I'd do it the exact same way. I would have started earlier. Because when you could read Russian, I can't speak it very well, but I can read it, no problem. You are granted entry into a completely different world. Now, do not trust Google Translate or Yandex or any of these, Bing especially. They are disastrous, and you'll end up looking like an idiot if you try to pretend that you know what's going on with using one of these. Maybe with Romance languages it's okay, but not with anything that hasn't used another alphabet that has fewer speakers in the American world. Like, you know, like Spanish or French are usually pretty good, but not the rest. Certainly not anything that requires a different alphabet or even pictograms like Chinese. That's out of the question. So Americans have been given a ridiculous, fraudulent, knowingly false and distorted image of old Russia. Needless to say, that's bearing its rotten fruit today. This concept that Donald Trump was elected in part because of Russian hacking makes me laugh. These people control the world's armies. They control the world's media. They control the universities. And this is what they come up with? It doesn't even make sense. If they're hackers of that ability, why would they leave footprints that lead right to? The very fact, I know the guy who founded McAfee, the antivirus software, said the other day, he said any hacker of any note is never going to leave footprints. And what they usually do is leave footprints. If hacking does happen, they'll leave footprints to one of their enemies. But if they're that good, they could hack into and hack into the DNC, whatever the accusation is, then they're good enough to cover their tracks. And to this day, we have no names. No one wants to go on record with this stuff. And largely now, the Washington Post has retracted a lot of this stuff. But it doesn't matter. One of the reasons it had any momentum at all was because what Americans know about Russia, what little bit they know, is completely false. Russians are one group of people. Actually, there's more than one, but they're one of several that it is okay to publicly condemn and hate as a race, as an ethnic group. And they are seen to be, now what's going on now, it's more than just bad media coverage and bad history and stupid people, misinformed people. Now it's the building to warfare. American troops are now in Norway. They're in Poland, and they're massing in Turkey and anywhere that it connects anything on a Russian border that they're allowed to go, that's where they are. No one knows why. No one has given a solid reason as to why. Russia doesn't have the resources right now to invade any place. only the Americans are the aggressors here, as any fool could see. But as we all know from studying Johnson's Law, that since there are so few people who really know what's going on over there, and there's this general mist of distrust for anything Russian, most people, otherwise intelligent and discerning, will go, yeah, they must be doing something wrong. But the ruling class is now putting a huge number of forces on the Russian border. And remember, too, that will automatically mean war with China. Since the SCO, the military pact between Russia and China, has been quite vehemently suppressed. There's been, obviously, the fact that a war with Russia, which is talked about on the front pages every single day, if this would mean a world war, that would be noted, you would think. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization is sort of the NATO of a type, where China would be obligated to fight, and they would have actually good strategic reason to help Russia if anything really goes down. That's been repressed because, and it's clearly, I mean, a lot of these guys simply don't know, but not all of them. They're aware that that would frighten the Americans. And, you know, American servicemen are not really used to enemies that could fight back. You know, they're not exactly the soldiers for democracy that the regime tries to paint them. They're mercenaries. And they're going to be coming home in heaps of body bags if this continues. And since the U.S. has nothing to fight for, there's no ideals, there's no unity, there's no money. We could get it from China. Any interest in the war is going to collapse pretty quickly. And you just say, thank God that Putin's in charge of Russia and is commander-in-chief of the armed forces, because he knows he will outplay the U.S. as he's done many times in the past. And that's why, it's one of the reasons, that I've never been proven more right about a topic. I was saying in the mid-90s that Russia is going to be the center of the war against the New World Order. You go to my old website, which was rushjournal.com, and go to the Wayback Machine. My earliest essays in 2004, I think, I was saying all this. I was just a bit early in my predictions, but it's all come to fruition. And Russia has never been a problem because in the past it was part of the Soviet Union. Marxism was not a problem. Most American diplomats couldn't tell you what Marxism is, you know, in any kind of detail. The problem, as always, will be and will always be nationalism. It's when a very powerful country decides to question the American way of dealing with things, that's when suddenly they'll become an enemy. And that's the only time they become an enemy. So that's why this show exists. And that's why we're talking about St. Daniel, the first prince of Moscow today. And in some small way, I have to undo decades and decades and decades of misinformation from the American ruling class. Initially, Moscow was allied with Ryazan and Novgorod. Now, Novgorod is one of the main players of old Russia. It was one of the most Western-looking of all the Russian city-states. That's what these all were, in essence. They had strong division of powers. In Kiev, for example, you had an oligarchy, you had local guilds, and you had a monarchy with a military aristocracy directly underneath it. So you had a separation of powers, plus the power of the church was essential for all what we would call today social issues, things like, you know, sexuality and marriage and divorce and child rearing, things like that. And canon law was the law of the land in the day-to-day practices. And local custom was always okay. You know, there's no such thing as paganism. I've never seen a creed or even a workable definition of the term. It's just a secular, poetic, metaphysical way of looking at things. You know, I mean, maybe the simple people believed in the gods, but, you know, intellectuals, you know, people like Hesiod didn't believe that they were a Muhammad-type figure. They weren't you know, catalysts of the divine will. They were simply reporting the, you know, primordial traditions of the people in the Eastern Mediterranean. That's all he was doing. He wasn't talking about God at all. And it's a terrible mistake to refer to paganism as a religion, and it's an even worse mistake to refer to these archetypes, these heroes, these symbols as gods. You know, Yahweh, you know, Allah, that's what God means. They're creators, they're powerful, all powerful. these gods were not creators. They were arrangers at best. Creating ex nihilo did not exist because the concept didn't exist. In fact, the concept of zero took a very long time to penetrate in the West, because they couldn't understand something where the symbol of something is more substantial than the thing that it signifies. It actually came from India. Now, I say all this because the ancient cultural traditions, which is what essentially what paganism is, so long as they didn't directly conflict with something that the church was interested in, this goes for Western Europe as well as Eastern Europe, it was left alone. There was never any dual faith at the time of St. Daniel because paganism is not a religion. Paganism, at most, is a philosophical or poetic, literary approach to the world. It was a way to humanize the world. It was a way to encode knowledge and understanding of social forces and natural forces using personification. We do it all the time. We personify our cars. We personify musical instruments. You know, B.B. King called his guitar Lucille. You know, we personify things all the time. That doesn't mean we believe that they're actually real people. It's just that human beings have this tendency. It's been repressed in modern times because personalization, the existence of a personality, is the substance of myth. And remember, the idea of myth with a capital M is something that is true in essence, but fanciful in detail. So paganism shouldn't be compared with Christianity or Islam. These different pagan systems should be compared with a literary tradition, or even a philosophical tradition, especially in the East. Novgorod was one that had its roots in the West. It was the largest member of the Hanseatic League. And the reason why you have to talk about it first and foremost is because it was the wealthiest part of Russia by far. It was deeply entwined with the German city-states and in international trade. It had a large foreign population, had a large Jewish population. It had a substantial oligarchy that controlled every aspect of the city. It was never trusted for this reason. Tsars and emperors always looked at Novgorod as they clearly were Russian. They were Orthodox on occasion. Paganism always did well there because paganism, at least in that part of the world, was very material and very carnal. Not always, of course, but in that part of the world it was. And so it was very attractive to people who rule with money. The oligarchy was always represented in Novgorod. And the thing about oligarchs, you have to remember, is that they care about one thing, and that is their money, keeping it, and making more of it. That is pretty much all they have. And so at this period of time, up until Ivan the Fourth or Ivan the Terrible, so a few hundred years here, Novgorod is always looking to get out of the Russian Federation of Principalities because they realize that the only enemy of oligarchy is monarchy. Now, in a more broad sense, the enemy of materialism is the nation. In a political way, but the Christian nation specifically, the Orthodox nation. So however you want to slice it, you can be more broad and more specific, it's the same idea. Monarchy is about the common good. Monarchy implies a nation and a strong church. It's a religious institution. It is not a secular institution. It has never been in Russia and elsewhere. In Russia, it is very much a religious institution up until Peter the Great. And we've talked about that on this show, about what he did to the monarchy and what he did to the church. But this period of time, the prince was understood as primarily a religious figure, as well as a war leader. Those two things were never contradictory. They never have been, never will be. Christianity is a violent movement with enemies, not our personal enemies, but our enemies of the church. That's always been the case. You can't have a Christian empire in Byzantium or Serbia or Bulgaria without violence. It seems that today people have converted to Tolstoyanism, thinking that they're Christians. That's never the case. Our personal enemies, that's a total different matter. We turn the other cheek to them. And we certainly do it to our personal enemies who are Orthodox. Enemies of the faith, enemies of our people. If we don't stop them, I mean, we know that they're violent, they're invaders, whatever it is, and we don't stop them, we're responsible for what they do. Now, the monarchy represents that mentality, the idea of sacrifice for the common good. Oligarchy is its complete polar opposite. They don't care. They have no interest in the common good. They may talk about it, but they don't believe it. And throughout this roughly three centuries we're talking about here, the oligarchy in Novgorod were slave owners, a few of them. That's pretty clear. The only slave owners in Russia at the time. And they were always willing to leave Russia and even leave Orthodoxy. And this is why Ivan III, Ivan IV, all had to invade the area and throw out the ruling class of Novgorod. Whoever ruled Novgorod was a very wealthy area. Novgorod's big weakness was that it couldn't grow its own food. It was mostly swampland up there. And they traded in goods, which at the time, things like honey and timber and furs, especially furs. The best fur in the world came from northern Russia. This is where they made their money. So they were vulnerable, though, when it came to food. And, of course, because they were part of the Hanseatic League, they were vulnerable when it came to the world economy at the time, the European economy. Tver was initially unified with Moscow, but then the Mongols were concerned with the most powerful city-states of the north being in union. Tver, the Grand Duchy, Novgorod, Moscow, Vladimir, Suzdal, this just the core of the northern Russian world. Now, all of these areas spoke the same language. All of these areas had the same customs. All of these areas were Orthodox in religion. They had a lot of the same assumptions. The Mongols, however, made certain, regardless of their ethnic background, they were still conquerors, and they maintained a divide-and-conquer ideology. Alexander of Tver used the Grand Duchy of Lithuania to expand. Michael referred to himself as a defender of all things Russian, and he took some of the northwestern parts of the Muscovite region. And his ideology, as was the case in Moscow actually did it successfully, was to unify this northeast of Russia. St. Michael, again, he was a saint in the church, although an enemy of Moscow, was aggressive. He wanted his own metropolitan. He wanted to be Russia. Everyone knew that unification was absolutely essential. After the Mongols, everyone knew that division could not last. So from the Mongols' point of view, since they did not occupy the country directly, they needed people who were loyal to them. This is one of the pieces of evidence that these were not foreigners, ethnic or racial foreigners. And that is that Moscow remained a loyal servant of this group, the Mongols, whatever you want to call them, throughout this period of time, and it paid off. Because whenever these princes were at war with each other, and Tver and Moscow were now fighting all the time, that was soon to rupture. Uzbek, especially, and his predecessors believed that the nightmare, they had two nightmares. Nightmare number one would be the union of Moscow with Tver and Grand Duchy of Lithuania. That would be a huge, very powerful coalition. The second nightmare they had was in the south of the country, the unification of Hungary, Poland, and Galicia. That would be two different religions. But you did have the Galician oligarchy. Another area, Galicia was very powerful. They were Orthodox, but they had tremendous salt mines, and they were very close to the Greek world. And now after 1204, things changed for a while, but only for a while. At least the one in the north would be completely Orthodox. One in the south, though, could become very powerful regardless of the religious differences. Now, in terms of Lithuania later on was really starting in the 14th century, joined with Poland in a looser and then more gradually a stronger federation. What ended up happening is that Catholics were dominant, and they essentially chased the Orthodox out of Lithuania. There isn't much research, and I'm in the process of fixing that right now, on the Orthodox Church in the Grand Duchy of Lithuania. It was actually very strong. It was very vibrant. No one knows that much about it. Unfortunately, you have to know the language in order to even do the beginning of research on it. But this was an Orthodox state, so keep that strictly in mind. It wasn't going to last long, but Lithuania was an Orthodox Russian state that even at one point, prior to these unions with Poland, viewed itself as a leader of Russia and a legitimate claimant to this title against Tver and Moscow. Keep in mind, Moscow was destroyed in 1293. Andrew, Daniel's brother, had attacked the country or the region using Mongol forces. This was really the only time that being loyal to the Mongols did not pay off. They quickly rebuilt. And this is what happens. You're dealing in a situation where you had a very healthy, very young population, really a new civilization that the world was slowly but surely taking notice of, that was growing in power. Something else about Novgorod was that their oligarchy was deep into the Mongols. They were the primary group that paid off the Mongols to leave them alone. Novgorod was never conquered by the Mongols. This is partially because of how swampy and ugly it was up there. The Mongols did everything like the Cossacks today, did everything on horseback. And where horses couldn't go, they didn't go. So, but they rebuilt. And Moscow was attacked again just right after by Alexander, right after Daniel's death in 1303. It was attacked, in 1305. But finally, the Muscovites, with Mongol assistance, destroyed. And pretty much after 1328, the horde had enough. The Mongols had enough with Tver. They were too Western. They had too many tentacles with Novgorod, and especially with Lithuania. And that was too Western for them. And the last thing they wanted is this huge Western coalition against them. Anything that would produce a powerful coalition against them, they would fight. Tver didn't have much of a chance. Number one, its material base was very weak. Number two, they didn't have Mongol support ever. They were simply too militant. These were great Orthodox leaders. I'm not opposed to them. They did what they thought was correct, and I can understand their point of view. We venerate them every year in church. Alexander and Michael both were killed as martyrs, and they're venerated by the Moscow church just like any other in the Orthodox world. They were too militantly anti-Mongol, which is admirable, I guess. But ultimately, it forced them to go to the West, and no one liked that. Remember, Moscow, Novgorod, at their best under Nevsky, not the oligarchy. But there were many, Vladimir Suzdal, that they were willing to work with the Mongols if it meant avoiding Western colonization. Right after the Mongols invaded the area and took much of southern and central Russia, the Pope responded by declaring a crusade against the schismatics. And remember, this isn't too long after the 1204 debacle in Byzantium. Tver had nowhere to expand. They had Moscow to the south, they had Lithuania to the west, and Novgorod, which wasn't going to give an inch, and certainly you couldn't irritate Novgorod if you were Tver. It was never that large. It didn't have a strong, it didn't have a centralized monarchy like you had in Suzdal, Vladimir, or Moscow. You didn't have the oligarchy that you had in Novgorod or Galicia, or Kiev for that matter. It was sort of in the middle, more like Pskov rather than Novgorod, but Pskov was sort of in between as well. But the future belonged to rulers, institutions that supported the common good. So it was a strict monarchy, meritocracy in terms of hiring, in terms of administration and military forces, and the support of the church. In Russian history, the church was always the hero. The church always was the unifier and was at war with the oligarchy. The church offered, thinking just now from a political point of view and no other, it offered the ideological backdrop. We are all Russians. We all speak the same language. We all believe this way. Byzantium didn't like the Russian church increasingly, especially in Suzdal and Vladimir. These were heavily centralized, forested areas, because they didn't like Greeks coming in. There was way too many oligarchs who had ties in the Greek world. The Italians, in Genoa especially, were trading pretty briskly with the Mongols. So clearly these are highly civilized people who knew European languages and were very easily able to interact with European peoples. Again, another piece of evidence that they really weren't from China or even Central Asia. The economic base of Tver was weak. There was no particular ideology backed up by a strong church and a strong monarchy. monarchies were not institutions. They were rather the results of very powerful personalities. And that hurt them to a tremendous extent. Being hemmed in by these powers, you know, by 1309, 1310, Tver was completely surrounded. It had reached the apex of its development. The monarchy wasn't strong enough, and it never got the metropolitan that it sought. It went to Byzantium, went elsewhere, looking for a metropolitan. Having your own metropolitan meant that the Greek empire, the one legitimate source of political authority, said that you are now an independent country with your own metropolitan and therefore your own independent church. Many regions at the time tried to get this, and Byzantium's point of view was very consistent. Once they recovered from the shock of 2004, and the Greeks in exile finally retook their country and their society back, very strong Greek nationalists at the time, they saw the Slavs as one people. From Galicia to Novgorod, from Volyn to, you know, the Ural Mountains, they saw the Slavs as a very strong, very powerful Orthodox nation that would make one heck of an ally if they were ever in trouble again. St. Peter, the Metropolitan of Moscow, technically he was the Metropolitan of Kiev, but then the church moved from Kiev to Vladimir and then from Vladimir to Moscow. They went where they could be safe, where their building program could go unhindered. They needed cash. They needed workers. They were builders. St. Peter, St. Maxime, these saints, these metropolitans, had a strong ideology, something that the Tver never developed. And they were never granted their own metropolitan. They eventually came under the Metropolitan of Moscow, who still maintained, by the way, the title of Metropolitan of Kiev, despite the fact that they hadn't lived there in a long time. No fault of Kiev. Kiev had just simply come under influences from Hungary and Poland and was no longer the dominant force that it had been in the past. Moscow proved itself to be safer. It was safer because they cooperated with the Mongols. It was safer because it was growing massively in population from all over the Slavic world, not just Kiev. You know, Kievan refugees went everywhere, not just to the east. It was safer because there was a strong church, strong ideology, and they were used for a long time as the tax collectors of the Sadai monarchy or the Mongol monarchy in the southern part of the country. And so they had excess cash. You know, these are some of the reasons that Moscow became dominant. And Moscow, under Daniel's son, Ivan I, used every method possible, including Mongol support, to grow and to develop. Having their own metropolitan, having a strong monarchy, which Daniel founded, with a strong ideology, this became absolutely essential in developing the Russian idea and a unified Slavic Orthodox state without the church, without people like St. Peter and monarchs like St. Daniel, there would be no Russia today. Now, I've mentioned this ideology more than once. The testament of Ivan I, the son of Daniel, is absolutely essential. Moscow had tremendous benefits of long reigning, very strong, very religious, very motivated kings that had absolutely no truck at all with oligarchy. Any society that could do that, that could make that work without giving in to the sick ideology of the oligarchs is going to win. Ivan, as Daniel's son, he gets this from his father, saw himself as Prophet Jeremiah, chapter 29. Once the captivity is over, that is to say, once this foreign entity, the Mongols, was going to weaken, captivity is over. The result then is a renewed, refreshed Christian people with a good king. And he viewed himself that way. The central position was absolutely invulnerable. Ivan I eventually took Rostov and isolated Vladimir by 1363, quite a long time after the death of Daniel, but Daniel's ideology is to be found here. Muscovite rulers knew that they would be ruling Russia, and their testaments prove this. the restoration of order. These men were aware of their responsibilities and the fact that they would die, possibly die young. They did not, thank God. They died natural deaths. But they saw most of all the ruling class, the nobles, the oligarchs, as the lawless ones. Prince Daniel and his sons Yuri and Ivan saw the prophet Daniel as the most political book in the Bible and their favorite book of all of scriptures. Ivan Kalita's vision coming from his father Daniel also is to be found in his testament in Isaiah chapter 32, the first verse. Keep something in mind here. In all of these cases, they're going to the Old Testament, which backs up what I've been saying for a long time, that the Old Testament is the political vision of the church. Christ didn't say anything political, really, partially because the prophets already took care of it. They were very political and very economic. They had a fully developed ideology in this respect. The book of the law, Deuteronomy, all of this was laid out, rejected by the Talmudic Jews, but maintained by the few Karaites, who were, generally speaking, good people. You know, we say Jew, we mean Talmudist. We don't mean just, you know, the term in the Middle Ages, the term Jew referred to a Talmudist. It did not refer to the Karaites. If you rejected the Talmud, you were not a Jew. You were treated in the same way of maybe as a Muslim would be or a pagan would be. And whenever the Jews were kicked out of a country, the Karaites were not included among them. Now, there have been times they were done accidentally, but when they could show that they are Karaites, they rejected the Talmud, they were not treated the same way as it was anti-Talmudism, not anti-Jewry. That was the question. And the Talmud rejected the prophets as burning in hell, especially Isaiah, because they dared criticize Israel and the rabbis. Rabbi leadership, so to speak, rabbis in quotes. That verse in Isaiah 32 is that a king shall reign in righteousness. So you have a king, meaning a unified legal force, representing the unity of God, number one. Number two, it'll reign. He'll have power. This won't be a symbolic matter. This won't be an iconic matter. He has to take day-to-day actual policy action in union with the church to promote his agenda, especially in a chaotic time we're talking about now, before Moscow completely took over, and that he will reign in righteousness. In other words, this isn't just a matter of power. Oligarchs generally had more power than monarchs did. Today in the West, they rule entirely without any conception of the common good. Righteousness meant that it had to be a Russian Orthodox monarchy, following the canon of the church, and churchmen, you know, monastics, Daniel, before he died, became a monastic. This is very common amongst Russian monarchs and Serbian monarchs as well. And as Moscow develops, the need for a new code, a new law code develops. They make reference to Hezekiah in the Old Testament. The king defends the faith. And what that means is it talks about the truth to power, whoever that power might be, the common good, the truth of all of our political actions. It's not just a matter of taking over. And truth is to be manifest in a set of laws. And then the result of that equation is justice. And one of the essential concepts is that the family and the peasant commune is granted very special status. Ivan the Terrible, Ivan the Fourth will even grant more status not too long after this to the peasant commune. And they did view the nation as a extended family. To think that nationalism didn't exist in this era is laughable. It did. 13th and 14th century. It existed in Byzantium. It existed in Muscovite Russia. All of these places, Tver, Novgorod, these were all Russian Orthodox people, regardless of the sins of the leadership. And most of all, because of evil of the oligarchy, the poor do require special treatment. They must be supported while they get on their feet again. And really getting on their feet meant to be a part of a communal structure, especially in the northern parts of the country. So this is the vision. This is the idea of St. Daniel. He never wanted power. He was very meek personally, and it killed him. And you read this at the time, contemporary writings, having to fight his brother Andrew, these things, it killed him. Any good man doesn't like fighting his own brother and killing other Slavs, but he had to do it. Using Mongols to help him out kill them even more. But he didn't see any choice in the matter. And he became a monk and gave away mountains of money as a way to give alms to have these sins forgiven. This is the kind of vision that these monarchs had. This is what old Russia was. Anyway, I have gone over my time. I thank my friends for listening to me, for supporting me, for making me a radio success that I never thought I can do. And my enemies, as stupid as you are, as thick-headed as you are, you do keep me on my toes. So I thank all of you. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.